Turn with me in your scriptures to Hebrews chapter 7. Vic, I really thank you for just serving us this morning and leading us to the Lord. And as I mentioned to you yesterday, I'm part of a group that's really digging into the book of Hebrews at the moment. And I, just as we were singing this morning and praying, this passage came to mind. And just when you let what this is saying really sink into your heart. Because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Just think of that. Because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, because of that truth, therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him. Because he always lives to intercede for them. Such a high priest meets our need, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other high priests, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. He sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself. What a rich, rich passage. To think that we have a high priest who lives, he always lives to intercede for his people. And then, of course, as you look through the book of Hebrews, you see on a number of occasions, like in chapter 3, verse 1, we're told to fix our thoughts on Jesus. Therefore, holy brothers, who share in the heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus, the apostle and high priest whom we confess. And of course, as we saw yesterday, the similar thought in Hebrews 12, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. So that was a good time this morning, just to begin our time doing just that, to fix our eyes upon Jesus. Well, today we've got a pretty full day. We have three sessions together, two before lunch and then one after lunch. And we're going to continue the track we're on. And I'd like you to feel free to ask questions, make comments. Man, I tell you, I don't have a monopoly on this stuff. And there's a tremendous amount of experience in this room. And so if you have insights, you have thoughts, you have questions, just please contribute those. Now, sometimes when you ask a question, I may just make a choice like I did a couple of times yesterday, just not to go down there because of what it'll cost us and other things we want to cover. But I'd like us to have that time. Well, I'd like us to have that environment where we can do that. We'll be breaking up this time with small group work as we go through and so on. Just very briefly, you remember yesterday we began with using this just to help us think. Huh? What?
You redrew it last night.
No. This was always there. I just forgot it was there. Oh, boy, that feels better. We talked about how, basically the point was, either consciously or not consciously, in our ministry, all of us are acting, choosing from some form of mental construct about how we think about ministry. And what I was endeavoring to do was to track this back and explore with you a construct of thinking about ministry. Now, it's not a construct about any ministry. It's a construct about a multiplying or generational ministry. And that's where we began together to build the construct. And just to give you an overview, I walked through this together. We tried to illustrate it. We took bullet points. Because when you get into when you look at the CD, you're into the sort of the nuts and bolts. And this is sort of the high altitude view of what this construct is about. And the big point is that all those elements or all those critical factors, critical in the sense that they are vital, critical in the sense that if you overlook one of these as you're undertaking another part, it will impact on what happens down the road in ministry. It may not show up for a while, but it will eventually. So we explored together the interconnectedness between the pieces. And we spent time looking at the interconnectedness between vision, prayer, focus, access and rapport, and teaming. And we explored that each of those are foundational blocks that affect what happens here to generations. And then we took some time, I think at the end of the session I had with you, had one more after that with Bill, where we broke into three groups and we said, how might thinking foundations and generations from the beginning affect the way you would approach going to the lost? How might that mindset affect that? How might it affect the process of discipling? And we'll come to that for the bulk of today, and certainly the next two sessions. And building community. What I'd like to do in the session this morning, however long it takes us, is to say, now, how do we use this? Because I heard a number of you say, and you know, as I talk with some of you, it seems as if, one of the things I'm hearing is, we can get a picture of where we think God wants us to be. You know, if we think 3 years out, we can get a bit of a picture of that. And then, you remember I talked about the importance of naming and describing your current realities. And we talked about why that can be a bit scary, and we sort of talked about some of the reasons that might be. But here's the thing. If this is our current realities, and we get a picture out there of where God might want us to be in light of our core, how do we move from here to there? Because we can't just, I'm not going to try my back or go up, but we can't just take one big leap. You know, we've got to take faith steps. But how do we take those faith steps so it's not like this? See? It's just busy. There's a lot of activity. There's a lot of movement. But is it actually moving us towards where God wants us to be? And, you know, let's talk about that. And, you know, you'll be able to build on this. I can't dig down into the reality of your context. I'm aware that as I look around this room, there's diversity of context. You are the best people to take these thoughts, these principles, and figure out how does that work in our context. That is something that, you know, you are the best people to do that. The best solutions are local for those issues. Anybody want to make a comment, question about where we got to? Yeah, yeah, Chris.
Could you tell us exactly why you have that visual? Why generations on the one side, foundations on the left? Why those four in the middle?
Yeah.
Were there any other visuals?
Thank you. Good question. Yeah, I think when we first began this, we had these critical factors in a line. Okay? So we had going to the lost, discipling our generation, building community, developing leaders, or laying foundations, and generations. Problem. So you mean it's linear? You mean we've got to start with going to the lost, but we've already got 100 people around. See, so figured out that didn't help. We looked at a few others that I can't remember. The reason we've landed on this, and if you come up with a better way, please give it to me. I'll use it. Is to show that is to really emphasize the interconnectedness and how, as you undertake these vital factors in a ministry, you must always be undertaking them with those two things in mind. Because that is crucial to our calling. See, our calling is not to advance the gospel by adding the numbers of spiritual laborers. It's spiritual generations of laborers. We want God to use us for this thing to become a movement. Well, that must affect what happens here. So it's the interconnectedness from the beginning that we're trying to emphasize, rather than a linear set of activities. It's a way, this is why I'm using the word mental construct. This is, it's a mental construct that then has to be fleshed out, worked out in your context. For example, at the last mentor gathering, I had a great hour or two with senior collegiate staff, just brainstorming on how does this look in a campus setting where you might only have the students for 4 years. See, that's a different setting than when you know that you've got them much, much longer. What's that? Could be. I just look at, I look at my neighborhood. I look at some of the business settings. It varies, but we've had two or three people in the neighborhood move out. The bulk is still there 5 years later. But I think your point's probably valid. It was an overstatement. We have mobility beyond the campus, without doubt. Thanks for that.
You need to speak up. That for a generational ministry to be functioning, to be healthy, all four things have to be functioning.
These four things?
All four things have to function.
What John's saying is, for a ministry to be healthy and functioning, all these four need to be happening. Anyone want to comment on that? Phil?
This isn't exactly John's question, but we, in our mission, have chosen to look at the outcome for our whole sphere. So we're looking at a system approach. So, for example, we may have one ministry where we honestly are not going to see spiritual generations out of that ministry because of the nature. But if we don't see it contributing to the whole, we probably will be significantly limited to the system's production, let's say, of spirit, or the system's contribution, maybe a better way to put it, of spiritual generation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you just look, microscopically, in our view, it takes away some of the power of the illustration.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, we certainly like, in many of our multiplying ministries, see this taking place all the time, because these are bedrock issues for our ministry.
Yeah.
Maybe to help illustrate a little bit, as you've been talking about this over the past couple of days.
Can you hear?
God has placed me into a Christian adventure camping responsibility, and so
you know, I'm trying to lay this over top of what my new responsibilities are. And so right now I'm working very hard on building the community to try to impart to our staff what generational multiplication looks like. So that becomes a discipling effort on my part with them that develops leadership, and then we know our constituency of people coming. We have people who are genuinely believers and some who are not. So we have that opportunity for evangelism that lays on top. The goal is that we are able to create the kind of environment that will bring people back repeated times so that we can finish maybe the whole aspect of you know, building those disciples, and then have, we know that they're going to go on to do other things. So that's kind of how I'm looking at that. But I'm thinking as soon as I get back, I want to sit down with our staff and go back and make sure we understand the foundation so that we know where we're going. So that's how I see it. That's why I said all four.
Let me thanks, John. Let me make a comment, because I'm thinking this as I go, so just bear with me. I guess I'd probably say it like this. If we're leading a Navigator ministry, we must have in mind all of those critical factors. We must have them all in mind. Our particular context may lead us to be more focused on several of those factors. For example, if you're in a pioneering situation, the focus of what you're going to be about is going to be a lot on going to the lost and building community and then beginning to disciple. That's where the focus of your time is going to be. But unless you are doing that with the others in mind, the way you're doing that will set a course. That's one point I would make. The second point I would make is, as I look at this and think of the reality, as Mike pointed out, of the mobility of people's lives, life seasons, life choices. For me, when I look at our calling, and then I look at the journey of life that people undergo, this to me creates tremendous urgency and an imperative on the need to work together across our entity lines. Now, why do I say that? I can think of situations where we see in neighborhood and community ministries the children are coming to faith. Now, once those kids get to about 18, where do they go? College. And military, thank you. I was going to make, you've got to forgive me, when you understand the state of the armed forces in the country I come from, you can understand why our national anthem is God Defend New Zealand, because there's no way our Air Force could. Okay, so that's why you get that. Okay, now, if we're just thinking at this point, silo, community ministry, entity ministry, just thinking silo. When those kids go off to the military or the college, having perhaps begun the journey of discipleship, if we're just thinking silo, they're gone. Unless we think, how can we do all we can to connect them to our brothers and sisters who are part of the Navigators in their context? So two things. We may focus on aspects of this more because of our context, because of where people are in life. Secondly, we may need others beyond our entity or beyond our context to play their part in this total process if we're to see generations of laborers. Does it make sense? Comments? Steve.
Foundations are laid, and the end view is not just our silo, but it's what might be beyond that. So that, you know,
yeah.
In the neighborhood with children, not just thinking in that neighborhood, but collegiate and marketplace.
Yeah.
Foundation in mind that will be the ultimate endpoint of that person.
Okay, at the risk of being misunderstood, the end view, in my response, the end view is not just to have 58 metro areas so we can say we have 58 metro areas. That's not the end view. They are the vehicle or means we have adopted, or the way we've organized ourselves, because the end view is the gospel advancing in all of these places through people we call laborers, who generationally live and disciple among lost. That's where God's asking us to go. So we need strong metro missions and areas. We need them. That's not my point. But why do we want that? So we can say we've now got 58. It'll be a while before we say we've got 58. But so we say we've got this many rather than this many. It's bigger than that. This is a kingdom thing. Okay, John. let me get what you're thinking. What are you thinking the end view is? You want to listen? You're a wise man. So do I. No, I don't know whether I've got the gist of your question. Is the ultimate? Is there an ultimate end view? Yeah, I.
Whatever the end view is, will directly affect what we do in how we think.
Okay. Well, let me respond and see if I'm on track. What has God called us to as navigators?
That's right.
You know, well, wait until I say what I'm saying. You may not like it. I mean, I appreciate the encouragement, but. So, what is our calling? You know, I think we're clear. That is our calling. That is what God is calling us to give ourselves to. Now, is there an ultimate, something ultimately beyond that? I think there is. For me, I go to passages like Ephesians 1, verse 9 and 10, that through the advancing of the gospel into the nations, through people living their lives in a certain way among the lost, several things happen that are the ultimate purposes of God. You know, in Ephesians 1, 9 and 10, it talks about that which has been fragmented. God with his people, God with his creation, people with people, people with themselves. That God, through the gospel, is bringing back together again. That's what Ephesians 9, 10 talks about. Is bringing back together again that which was once together for the ultimate purposes and glory of God, which will make a statement not just to this world, but to the heavenly beings and so on. That's, for me, the big picture. That's the ultimate purpose. Have I followed the question? I think you're absolutely correct. Yeah. You know, no, I think you're right. That was my point. You may, because of the season of where you are in the ministry's development, be giving more focus or more attention. Like Joe, if I can use Joe. I mean, Joe, you're sort of getting things going there a few years at UCLA. Okay, now, so Joe is putting quite a lot of emphasis in one or two of those areas. But unless Joe is thinking of all of them and eventually ensures that they all occur either there or beyond, then yeah, that's the point of what we're saying. It will have an impact. In other words, we could have a great activity there, but in terms of moving us towards our calling, we're going to pay a price. That's exactly what I'm saying. Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You are illustrating perfectly how this construct helps us. And, you know, maybe you're pointing to the need for teamwork and coaching. Because if the person is pretty much isolated and alone in what's happening, it's kind of hard because they're probably ministering out of their preferences and gifts rather than what God's asking of us. But then maybe they're doing what they can do, and that without coaching or teamwork, they're going to struggle to see a full-orbed ministry. Yeah. But if we have a ministry, like one of the areas that I think hits us in the metro is one of the things the guys have picked up on is, you know, there's been a tremendous emphasis on fruitfulness. And we're seeing fruit. But God hasn't called the navigators just to fruitfulness. He's called them to fruitfulness to generations. See, a generational approach. So it's that way of thinking. It helps you correct and so on. Let me move on, because it sort of springs into, thanks, John, where we were going. How can we use this, what we've been talking about? And I think on the last page of the handout from yesterday, on the last page, you should see this something looking like this. You found it?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to give you a way forward at a fairly generic level. I'm always reluctant to dig too deep into your context if I'm not in your context. So here is one way of approaching this. Here is our calling. And our vision. Our vision is our faith picture of what that calling might look like in our context. So, for example, I know the collegiate entity has done a lot of excellent work on saying, what does this calling look like in the collegiate context? And as we said, that as you look at your current realities, this creative gap is created between where we are and what the picture or what the faith picture looks like. Now, one of the issues we may find is that as we look at our current realities and the vision, Doug's not here, is he? Doug McAlpine. Okay. Doug, what would be one of the points or the gaps that emerge for you and ISM?
Yeah. But so few of the staff even track their alumni.
Okay. The desire to see the alumni ministering back in their country, but so few of their staff seeming to have a heart for it or doing it. So there's a current reality. Now, let's say that becomes a mission critical issue. If that's where God's taking us, and we observe that our staff don't seem to have the heart for it or the know-how or the capacity, and there might be lots of reasons for that. What do we do with that? Now, let's come back to this. So we want to see our staff tracking on the alumni when they go back, seeing that as part of their ministry. That's the behavior we want to see, right? Now, the tendency is to just address it at the behavioral level. When you do that, you will often get compliance. But you will not get a motivating, compelling reason for doing it. Because for them to do that in the midst of all they have on, it's not like they're sitting around doing nothing. There are some choices they have to make to do that. Why on earth, in a busy schedule, would they make choices? A little nervous after talking about full stops yesterday. Why on earth would they make those choices? Because of what they think and believe. Now, so what I would suggest is in the case of ISM, I got more paper going here. In the case of ISM, I would use that mission critical issue as an issue or a question that would lead us, now here's, lead us into the aspect of the six critical factors that might address that particular issue. And you have that resource which you need to adapt. You need to adapt it to your context. But you would go to the part of the six critical factors and address the issue of biblical thinking and understanding. That's what that says. Biblical thinking of understanding. So, for example, you might want to have a look at the material on generation. You probably would want to have a look at the material on the apostolic ministry and the commitment of the apostolic team to the fruit of its ministry long term and track on that in the scriptures. Why? Because you realize that ultimately, unless these people have an understanding biblically and the Spirit of God grips their heart about this, you will get compliance because it's what needs to be done, but not compelling motivation. Now, out of that, so this would be study, and you can think of creative ways to do that. It's interaction. It's a learning community around that issue in the scriptures. Out of that, choices are made. Action steps emerge, which lead to implementation. Implementation. In the case of ISM, they make some choices, come up with some possible implications of what they've been studying, to act on that understanding. So now they're implementing their understanding. And you know what? That's where all too often we stop. All too often I've seen where we assume knowledge and choice will lead to ongoing implementation. But this is where coaching becomes so important. Coaching and what I call learning communities. Let me make a few comments about that if I could. And then I'm going to pause and let's just talk about this. So let's say I'm working with ISM and some people working with mainland Chinese at one of the big campuses. and they come up with some ways, some steps. They really get hold of why this is so important to the calling. They see it in the scriptures. And they decide that we really need to do this. We need to make some steps. Now, where a coach comes in is a coach says, what do you want to see? What do you want to be able to do over this next year? Talk about that. What steps are you going to take to move towards that? What hurdles or things will you have to overcome to do that? What will you need to continue to do? What might you need to stop to do to create the capacity to do this? What strengths have you got to build on? What resources do you need? And so on. You see, that's a coaching conversation. Then you just walk alongside monitoring that. That is one expression of coaching. For those of us who lead staff, that's a style of leading that's very, very needed. But all of us are stretched in our capacity to do that. And I think there is a complementary approach to coaching that we could unleash more than we are. And it's what I call, and I'll probably need to write this up, is peer coaching. This would be a situation where here's a ministry team. Here's a ministry team. The person with experience, the coach, or person who's coaching, may be geographically distant from them, may not be able to be there as much as they could benefit from. Well, what can we help them do together that could unleash learning potential? Because there's a lot of experience and giftedness here. And this is where I think we can serve by helping them understand how peer coaching can occur. And it's just to adopt a fairly simple model. And you see an illustration of it in Proverbs 24, verse 32. Proverbs 24, 32 was not written or given to give us this model, but it's an illustration of it. And that's the story, you remember, where the guy's walking in Proverbs 24. He's walking along the path, and he looks over, and what does he see in the fields? Well, they're all overgrown. They're weeds and all that sort of stuff. So what happens there? What happens, he's walking along, this is Proverbs 24, around verse 32. So he's walking along and he sees the field. So he experiences something. Has learning occurred yet? No. Experience has occurred. Proverbs 24, verse 32. I applied my heart to what I observed and learned a lesson from what I saw. Then he states the lesson, and we don't know, but presumably, or hopefully, did something about the lesson. So the applied my heart to what I observed, reflected, processed, thought about it, considered it, and out of that came some conclusions, some understanding, some lessons, which affected and led to implementation, which leads to further experience. Now, how can we use this model in the context of just giving people some way of learning together? Well, this team is coming together. They're a ministry team. They're a ministry team, say, in the inner city of New York City, or probably in the Bronx or somewhere like that. Okay, they get together. Dana comes along and she says, I'd like to share with you a case study or an experience of something that's happening for me in the ministry at the moment. So she tells the story. And I don't know what to do with this, or what do you think I should do? Now, what's our tendency at that point? Well, I would like to think so. I've often noticed we go to here very quickly, conclusions. What we need to do at that point is the rest of the team disciplines themselves to not just prematurely go to solution here, but they discipline themselves to interact around questions that process the case study. Why? How did that happen? What happened when that happened? You know, what? Those sorts of questions. Then the team, and if the team understands this process and agrees on the process, this can work. Then somebody says on the team, you know, let's move now and try and draw some conclusions about what we've been talking about. Let's try and just identify some lessons out of this. Okay, what of these lessons do you think we could apply to the situation and take a step forward? Or take a step forward. There is tremendous potential in the minds and hearts of the people who are the practitioners. And if we can just serve them by giving them a way to benefit and learn from their experience, we unleash tremendous learning capacity and increase the coaching capacity. That is vital, I think, to moving forward. Let's come back to this. Let's just pause and talk about this now. Comments, questions, additions, thoughts, problems, disagree with it, whatever.
I think it's a confirmation of what you said. Since I've seen this a few times, is how important it is for us to have a clear understanding of our current realities, then move into the biblical understanding process. So I think I heard that better this time than I have in the past. Would you agree that we need to have a clear understanding of our current realities as we're going into this process of the biblical understanding? Yeah.
Well, I would, because I think that provides the motivation and energy to get into the scriptures around the issue. The thing I get, some of you have heard me on this, the thing I get nervous about is just viewing the six critical factors as a Bible study process we did last year or the year before. Any other comments, questions?
In light of what you just said, somehow we need to move staff to a point where they're asking the questions, and then the Bible studies become a place they go for answers rather than a Bible study just to do. Is that what you're saying?
Yep. Okay, now how do you move, or how do you help your staff discover the questions? Let's talk about that. How do you help people discover the questions? Because getting the right question is like finding the right key for the door that leads to a place of great riches. What might be some thoughts on how to help? Did somebody hear? Joe, I'll come and then I'll come over to you, Bill.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, maybe if you process the current realities well with your team, then sort of like a demand is created, you know. Then I think if you process well, then people can see that, well, we better do something about this, or we better, you know, move somewhere. So I think the key is to process it well.
And then, to process it well, you're back to our, you know, coaching, peer coaching, that sort of scenario. Yep. Bill, and then I'll come to you, John. In Tom.
I think the key is in understanding. I would agree with what Joe said. The key is understanding what our vision is and what our current realities are, and identifying the gaps. Because until we identify the gaps, we really don't know what we need to be working on. And so that's a real key part of the process.
Just before I move on, Doug, was when you created, as your team did for your staff, this gap between longing and reality, did it in fact lead to some intensity of wanting to look at, or was that still, it didn't seem to? Well, the assumption is that if we help people process the gap between current realities and calling, it can lead to an intensity of wanting to learn and ask the questions. Did it?
Yeah. Part of that comes out of deep understanding and to work through what the calling really means. And as you deepen in your understanding of that, then it gives you more to work with your current realities.
That's a very good point, isn't it? Because there is a tendency to read into the calling your current reality and just to use language to reinterpret. So you raise a very helpful point there. To actually deeply wrestle with what this calling God is asking of us here is vital before you go to current realities. Did that make sense? Did you hear that? Yeah. If you go to current realities without an understanding of the calling, we may miss some of the strengths and needs we have. Then I was going to go. I know I had Tom, and then I'll come.
I think some basic review with the people that you're working with and making sure that you all agree that this is the calling and this is the vision, or at least get variations of what people's idea of where we ought to go. Ask people questions about what their individual passions are in regard to these things. Figure out where you need to team better with who you have and who else you need to get on the team is going to clarify whether you're going to be able to move any beyond where you are. And if no one has a vision and no one has a passion, and you may need a different team or somehow get in a study of the Bible for what we're called to do. But I'm basically saying review with who you have what people are really thinking. Don't just assume that you know and that everybody's on the same page.
Well, and I'm kind of glad Tom went first, because I'm kind of keying off of that. When you were talking about the coaching process and about the peer coaching process, what occurred to me at the time is that something that God's begun to impress on me is that in any given situation, God seems to put together the people that He wants us to use or to be involved with to accomplish the overall task. Each person has a piece of the puzzle. And so as you begin to express that to them, what that tends to do is to begin to create in them that everyone has value to this process. And so when you talked about staying in the process long enough before you go to, I think the tendency of us as leaders sometimes is to, we hear the solution, bang, we're on it. And not give enough time to give play throughout the team so that each one has an opportunity to participate as a part.
No problem. The Leadership Challenge book, I didn't fully appreciate it until recently. I read the chapters on vision, and what really was compelling to me was how you enlist others in your vision. And this has been a source of real study for me lately, is just the power of vision. He used Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream story, and what he said that I feel is so true about the navigators is that we can make the intangible tangible so that our constituents can see it, taste it, touch it, and feel it. Now, that's very gripping, and I love this. He said, leaders ignite the constituents' flames of passion by using powerful language, positive communication style, and nonverbal expressiveness. Leaders breathe life into a vision. And he said breathing life is really the literal definition of inspire. And our vision is so compelling that I think as leaders, we need to inspire. And that's something that I've taken away, you know, from this particular study. It's helped me.
I think my question, Mike, is, and I haven't said it out loud before, so this may take a minute. There are some people that want to think very, very well and get it all thought out and then act. And then there are some people that act and then ask questions. Somewhere in the middle there, it seems like there's health. And to be honest, a concern that I have is that we could spend so much time thinking and trying to think well about this that by the time we're ready to act, the people that do like to act have gone, have left us, because so many of us have spent so much time thinking well. I'm concerned for us. Just address that, because I know we want to think well, but to me, I think, yeah, let's take 5 minutes to review it and then go, as opposed to take 5 days again to review it and make sure we have it and then pray about going. Do you know what I mean?
What is it? What is it we're reviewing? What is it we're thinking 5 minutes about?
Well, say in this case, here's what God has called us to do. Here's our calling. Here's what we're thinking about. Here are these six critical factors. Whatever's pertinent in the situation. Now let's go. I think a concern, and a concern that I'm hearing, to be honest, is, wow, we are really, you know, dissecting this again and again and again and again. Is anybody doing this? Do you know what I'm saying? I'm trying to find the balance between creating an environment where we think well about this, but for how long do we just focus on thinking well? And when is it okay for the more intuitive to say, yeah, I think I've got it. Let's go.
Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and let me just use the diagram that's up here for a response. We always tend to start with the biblical thinking, learning, and understanding, but actually you can enter into that process anywhere. And I think for most navigators, they are implementers and doers. You can enter into that spot of this diagram where they are implementing and then coach them and then add biblical information. This is a continuous cycle, not just one time around. And so if you have, you know, people that live by principles, you can start with a Bible study. If you have people that live by doing, you start with implementation. If you have people that are stuck on questions, you can start with coaching. And so anywhere where they are, I think you can catch them where they are and help them where they are to the next step.
Yeah, a couple of comments, Mike, and then I'll come to you, Vic, and John. The assumption behind what you were saying, Mike, was to think of this in a linear way. We're not doing anything. We think. Now we've stopped thinking and we act. Now I know that's, but that would seem to be that. You know, so we've done our thinking. Let's get on with it. Whereas I think what I'm. Maybe imperfect. I am trying to communicate that this is an ongoing, cyclical process. It's not that, for example, see, the whole entry point into this is what we're doing. That's the entry point. It's the acting. My idea is not that we do that for 6 weeks and then start doing that. It's a process, a cyclical process. And I agree with Don. This is why some people are going to, well, even here, the whole entry point into this needs to be the current activity and lead to new activity. It is not to just sit around and philosophize. Now, I could say, but let me just leave it there. No, it's Vic and John.
He started with the premise that we are doers. So in starting with that premise versus, he may have been starting with the premise of, it seems like we're thinkers. And so wherever we start on that has an effect on our conclusion. So the real question is, and maybe it's by entity, are we really doers?
And we want to do both. We want to think well and do well, and we don't want to really do one to the exclusion of the other, and we probably don't want to do too much of just one. You know, great. Take it well. Now go. Hey, you're sure going fast. Pause a minute to think.
Do we learn from what we do?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good.
I think we're at a critical point in history because typically my experience has been in interacting with staff, not only in the collegiates but outside the collegiates, is that it doesn't really matter what these things are all about. You know, this is all going to change 4 or 5 years from now, so just keep on doing what you're doing. And I know you've all heard that before, perhaps have said that before, and many of us have. And I really see this as a pivotal point in history because this really matters. And Joe mentioned just a moment ago that this whole six critical factors, it really is a yardstick to put up against your ministry and say, am I doing a navigator ministry or not? And that's not going to change in the future. And I just think it's very subtle and easy for staff to think, well, I like this part or that part or these three parts, you know, and leave the rest out rather than asking the hard questions and realizing two parts aren't even in my ministry. And I need to make those kinds of adjustments, and I need some help to do that, you know. And it's just, I just see this as a very pivotal point in history that's very unlike anything we've faced before.
And in addition to that, I think what I really like about that is that it gives something to assess. And so I don't feel like we've really had something to put our arms around that we are assessing, so that all our ministries are being assessed that way, and we've, I think we've had trouble that way. So what this does is, for those who are in positions of leading, then as they move in to those that they're leading, then to bring this to the page 2 or 3 times a year to go, this is what we're assessing. This is what we're looking at. And then that will push it forward.
You'll see in the material, thanks, John, in the CD you've got, for each of these areas, there are sets of diagnostic type questions. Now you, again, they're more generic. You would have to take those, apply them to your context for that to have relevance. Let me just try and... We want to avoid setting up a dichotomy between thinking and doing. And traditionally, we have had people who, by temperament preference, will think till the cows come home, but they're not acting on it. But then I know other people who are frenetic in activity, who dismiss somewhat any attempt to think about what we're doing, but seem oblivious to the fact that all their actions flow from some mental understanding of ministry. So it's they're operating on some basis. And I think ultimately, however we do it, and I think this is where, without wanting to overcomplicate it, and I think maybe this is one of the points, Mike, that is implicit in what you're saying, is not everyone's the same. People have different learning styles. And, you know, there's a lot of research being done which helps people identify their learning style and then superimposes it on that learning cycle. And there are some people who will more by preference want to test some conclusions. Others want to get on and do it, then think about it. So let's be wise in the way we use this and tailor it to the people we're leading.
And give grace to each other along the way.
Yeah. I hope we do that. What would it look like to give grace to each other in this?
Well, the tendency, I think, Mike, would be to judge one another. Say, well, this one, he's just thinking all the time. What's he ever doing? He's thinking well about it. It would be nice to see him do something. And I hear that. Or this other one to say, well, I'm thinking well. I wish this person would think well. Well, what you said about learning styles, I think this is helpful, this discussion right now. Mm-hmm. Because we do all approach it differently. And the Lord is intersecting with each of us at different points in our journey. And we can't demand of him, of the Lord, that he does the same thing for each of us at this point in time. We're all at different stages, and I think we can give grace and really cheer each other on and say, yeah, that's a good application for you right now for where you are.
To do this. I guess my question is more, how do we give grace when, as leaders, we see that things are not actually going that well? You know, we look at it, I mean, it's okay to give grace and say, rah, rah, you're doing great. But what say we look at a ministry and we see no evidence, for example, of meaningful personal discipling occurring in a relational context. It's all large group and it's all going to the lost. And we're leading it. And we know, as we look at this framework of thinking, that we're going to pay a huge price for that in generations. Now, how do you lead into that and give grace? Let's talk about that. Well, let me just, and then I'll come over here.
I've started working off a definition of grace that your actions to me don't affect our relationship. And so, based on that, you can have this ministry, and I need to still show strong, committed love to you while at the same time helping you see the reality. But making sure that what they're doing in ministry doesn't change how I relate in my relationship with them. That it remains committed in love.
Let's get a few more thoughts. Remember, the question is, how do I operate in grace and still provide the leadership where there are obvious gaps?